middle of Shantai Tzvi, still of course. He was expelled from Constantinople. Not only expelled, he was given Malchus.
He was?
Yes, that means they whipped him.
This is
before he's declared it. He thinks he's Mashiach, but he hasn't convinced anyone else of that. Apparently, just wait a second, let me look back at my notes. Apparently what he did two very controversial things in Constantinople to get such significant reaction. One was he celebrated all three Yom Tovim in 1 week. Like in a random week in the middle of the winter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the other one is he instituted his infamous bracha of Matir Asur. That means he, like Kilo, would take a ham sandwich and say, what, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Matir Asur.
Wait, what does that mean?
He said a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Matir Asurim. The one who permits things which are forbidden.
Is that a real blessing on anything?
No, it's not. Well, it's a mockery on a bracha, and we say in Shemona Esrei. But it's a total mockery.
Matir Asurim
is in Birkas Hashachar. Yeah, but
yeah.
But over there it means something very different. Over there it's the fact that you can't get whatever. Okay. Anyway, the kitzer. This is Shabtai Tzvi's.
What does Matir Asurim mean in Birkas Hashachar?
Well, when you're lying down and asleep and you can't move, then you're like Asur, you're like tied down.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, this is a Shabtai, this is one of his infamous acts. And as a result of this, he was given Malchus, he was beaten, and also probably imprisoned. Now, around the same time, a little before this, he apparently made friends with someone whose name is Reb David Chabilo. Was a known Mukabal, a known Kabbalist from Yerushalayim. The Gershon Shalom's working assumption, which I think is reasonable, is that Reb David Chabilo felt bad for Shabtai Tzvi and attempted to teach him and help him some. It's of course not clear what details Reb David Chabilo knew about Shabtai Tzvi. Nonetheless, he befriended him, and as a result of this, went back to Shabtai Tzvi's original hometown of Izmir. Reb David Chabilo.
So, did people think he was Mashiach?
Not yet.
Having ham sandwiches?
No. We're not going to get there tonight because we started too late. But he had his famous or infamous press agent, who's going to make him very. He's going to really help him out a lot. And that pays for Shabbat get to the next
one. What time was this?
This is we are right now in Shabtai Tzvi's life in around 1663.
That's pretty recent.
1660, yes. The key year of Shabtai Tzvi is 1665, 1666. Those are the key years. Okay, so Shabtai Tzvi was originally from Izmir. In case we're not aware, Izmir is known also as Smyrna. Smyrna. And it's a city on the Turkish coast, on the Turkish Aegean coast, which until 1920 was the vast majority of people who lived in Smyrna, Izmir, were Greek. And the Jews who lived there were Yotzei Sfard, were largely the Yotzei Sfard, the Spanish exiles, dominated the community. Now, Shabtai Tzvi had been thrown out. He originally was from Izmir. He'd been thrown out of his hometown around 5 years earlier. He'd been thrown out because of his strange deviations. And that leads us to a mystery. What happened? How was he able to come back home if he had been thrown out once? Especially as the rabbi of Izmir, was still alive, the person who had thrown him out, whose name was Rabbi Yosef Iskafa, had thrown him out, he was still alive. So how did he come? How was he able to come back? So the working theory is because he was accompanied by a known Makobo, a known scholar, a known, you know, Wurnianic scholar, as they call them, David Chabilo. They were, you know, the Rabbanim said, okay, I guess he, you know, maybe he improved. So, anyway.
Where did he get these ideas?
Okay, we'll get there. We'll speak about that a little next week, I believe. Okay, but he came back to Izmir and stayed for around 2 years. It's very unclear why he left. That's like this part of Shabtai Tzvi's life. It's like Shabtai, the whole life story of Shabtai Tzvi from the beginning to the end is full of unclarity. And the reason why there's so much unclarity in Shabtai Tzvi's life is before he was known, people didn't pay that much attention to him. And after he was known, he had extreme followers, believers, and extreme opponents. So the historians are very puzzled by, I mean, there's a certain amount of fact which we mentioned in both places, but obviously neither side is completely objective in what they're writing. Anyway, so he was back home for around 2 years, and typically it's unclear why he left. They're two absolutely opposite stories. One story is he went on his own with his brother's blood. He had two brothers who lived in Izmir. His father's probably still, I'm not sure if his father's alive at this time. I don't have time to double check that. But his brothers were definitely alive. His brothers were merchants, relatively well to do. They weren't like, you know, crazy rich, but they were relatively well to do.
What was his profession?
He had no profession. If he wanted to have been mentally unstable and other things, that he would have been a competent Talmud Chacham. He was not. It's unclear exactly how competent he was, what level of competency he achieved. He certainly was basically competent. Basic competency he definitely had.
How did he survive before he became famous?
Okay. So, his brothers earlier had definitely helped him out. And the question here is, did he leave on his own will? Or no, he did some things which are not recorded, and his brothers were embarrassed by his presence. Because he was really a manic depressant. And when he was manic, he did a lot of very strange things. I mean, the standard strange thing was to pronounce the Shem Hashem the way it was written. That was like no big deal. By Shabtai Tzvi, that was like standard fare. That was like, that was not a chiddush at all. So, did he do something that was very embarrassing? I mean, he had previously dressed a fish up as a baby.
Wait, what?
Dressed a fish up as a baby, put this fish baby in a bassinet, and made some type of, you know, whatever with it. So, like, that's strange, you understand? He had tried to get the sun to stop, celebrated, you know, he did all sorts of crazy things. Married a Sefer Torah, that's a very famous thing.
He married a Sefer Torah?
Married a Sefer Torah.
That's very idealistic.
It's simultaneously idealistic and unstable.
We're all married to a Sefer Torah.
No, we're not, whatever.
I'm okay. Foolish like everyone else.
Okay, whatever. Anyway, the kids are, he may have done something very strange, and his brothers were very embarrassed, and as a result, they wanted him to leave. It's not, knowing the way brothers work, even it's not the fact that he appears in his next journeys, and he does appear to still have money. And again, he didn't do anything besides learn. Kilo, I mean, if he would have been stable, that would have been fine.
Most people who are manic, depressed, when they're manic, they're not like crazy. They just do things faster. They do things more. Right?
Okay, no, that's
you
true.
You don't get like crazy.
Yeah, okay, yeah, but the Shabtai Tzvi was different. Yeah. So anyway, when even if his brothers were embarrassed of whatever he had done, it still doesn't mean that they wouldn't help him out, because at the end of the day, he was their brother. You know, as the pasuk says in Yeshaya, "Mipsorach al tisalek," don't abandon your own flesh and blood. So we can't. The fact that he's supported by his brothers later on, and we will see that. We'll get back to that pretty soon. That doesn't mean that. That doesn't prove that he left on good or bad terms. In other words, did his brothers force him to leave Izmir, or he left on his own because he wanted to go to? When he was going from Izmir, he was going from Izmir to Eretz Yisrael. That was his plan. So he definitely. It could work either way that he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, because Jews always, as Reb Nachman said, wherever a Jew is going, he's on his way to Eretz Yisrael. Anyway. So either way, it's not the fact that his brothers kept supporting him does not prove what terms he left them. Were they embarrassed of him? Did he do something wild that they got embarrassed of him or not? We can't prove it from the circumstantial evidence that they were still supporting him. Okay, now what happened was he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, and he went a little out of the way. And again, for unclear reasons. Instead of coming straight to Eretz Yisrael, he first went to Egypt.
How did he do that? By boat?
Probably by boat. One sort of theorizes that in the mid-1600s, there was apparently faster and or better boat connection between where he was in Egypt and where he was in Gaza / Yaffa. It's hard to know. I didn't have time to check that out in a maritime fashion. It depends what. Oh no, not now. It's complicated. It depends what type of boats they were using, because if you're using a galley, if you're using a road boat, then you stay near the coast, and you go around the coast. It does not sound at all logical. He obviously was on a sail-driven boat.
Why do galleys have to
sail? Because galleys can't really go deep sea. Because they don't have the way they're made, which is long, which is flat with all that. They only have one sail, and the sail is not strong enough. The size of the sail. I don't totally understand boats. It's not even right. No, I've read enough about it that I understand something about it. But you need X amount of sail to boat size in order to have a wind-driven boat.
Which one just paddling across the sea, though?
In order to paddle, you have to have people paddle.
You have to do that along the coast, too, though.
No. Because when you're in the deep sea, when you're not near the coast, the sea is much choppier. And you also, you won't be able to navigate as well. Anyway, because he apparently went from Izmir straight to Alexandria, and apparently that was Shayos Mitzuyos, as they would say in the Lashon of Chazal, which means that was the easier way to do it. And that's very important, because when he went to Alexandria, he met a very important person there whose name was Raphael Joseph.
Is that his PR agent?
No, his PR agent he's going to meet later. Raphael Joseph is known as the Chalebi. The Chalebi. Chelebi. The Chalebi. The Chalebi. The Chalebi means, is a Turkish word, which means Lord. Like Lord Jacobowitz. You know? Lord Salisbury. You know, it's a noble title. And it was given to the head of the Jewish community in Egypt. And not coincidentally, the head of the Jewish community in Egypt was also... Okay, you ready for this one, Nathan?
Yeah.
The Persian in you will definitely like this. He was the head of the treasury, of the Egyptian treasury, and in charge of tax collecting.
He himself is not Persian?
No, he was not Persian. You think he has to be Persian to do that, right? No. Okay, so Raphael Joseph... He was a very classic example of a well-meaning you know, Svarni lay leader. He's very religious. Somewhat, you know, he supported rabbis. He liked Kabbalah. You know, it sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, really.
Right. Okay. And he was the head of the Jewish community in Egypt.
Delightful.
And he was connected with the Arizal's Talmidim. As a matter of fact, he had at his house at this time, he had Reb Shmuel Vital, who was Reb Chaim Vital, the Arizal's prime student. His son Reb Shmuel Vital, he convinced the Chalebi, Reb Joseph, convinced him to move from Damascus to Alexandria, and he supported him in learning Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. Yeah, so and he was also a very wealthy person. Shabtai Tzvi, why is that important? So Shabtai Tzvi shows up, he meets Rufal Joseph, and makes a good impression. It forms a positive impression, which is not really surprising. In other words, Shabtai Tzvi, as has been mentioned earlier, when he wasn't depressant, and when he wasn't manic, when he was manic, he did funny things. And it's hard to believe that the court rabbanim of Rafael Joseph's would have accepted Shabtai Tzvi if they would have met him doing his strange acts. So it's much more logical to believe he was in a normal state, because manic depressants have manic, depressant, normal. So the logic tells us that he must have been normal at that point. He himself was somewhat, he was knowledgeable in Kabbalah. He was competent in Torah. And more importantly, he did have two other things. He was a winning personality and knew how to make good connections. That's a known fact. He also was a very solid singer, chazan. You know, and these are very things he was able to make positive impressions on people throughout his life, from beginning to the end. You know, sometimes even whatever. But anyway, he makes a positive connection with Rufal Joseph, which is very important, as we're about to find on. Now, because Shabtai Tzvi goes on to Yerushalayim. This is around, this should be around, I think we're holding by 1663 right now. Yeah, no, we're holding by, no, 1662, we're holding by winter 1662. He goes on to Yerushalayim.
What did he do in Egypt? Say hi?
Yeah, he stayed there for a couple of months. It's not clear how long. Well, give him like 4 to 6 months in Egypt. He goes on, but what was important is he connects to Rafal Joseph. That is very important. Bezer Shem, we'll come back to that in a moment. He goes on to Yerushalayim, and he repeats the standard Shabtai Tzvi pattern, which is he shows up, in other words, he was thrown out of his mirror originally, and he repeated this pattern in at least three other places.
Before
he comes to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is another time he does it. He comes in again. He's competent. He knows something. He knows something in the Nigla, and a revealed Torah and a hidden Torah. He has a nice, you know, he's a nice person. He knows how to, you know, he makes good, positive first impressions. Until he goes manic. Then he goes manic.
What were, like, what were the time frames, like length of the cycle?
We don't know. They're not all. Only after he is declared Mashiach by Nasan, by his sidekick, Natan of Aza, who we're not going to get to this week. After that, then we have very clear documentation of his manic periods and his depressive periods.
How long were those?
The manic could be up to 3-4 months. And depressant could be around the same, and he could even be normal for as long as a year, year and a half.
Is that normal for most manic depressants?
Apparently.
To be around that time frame?
Apparently. Anyway, he comes through July, the basic Shabtai Tzvi pattern reasserts itself, which is he makes a good initial impression, until he does something funny. We don't know, in other words, when he goes manic, if you give him an aliyah to the Torah, then when he says Baruch Hashem, he doesn't just say Hashem, Ad Hashem. He says, well, you know, the way it's written. Which definitely makes an uproar. Now, Shabtai Tzvi reports having been given Malkus, having been beaten by the Rabbanim, by the rabbis of Jerusalem.
Because of that?
No, we don't know why. We find it's... That's strange for the records. That's an Isser. You're not supposed to do that.
Oh, say the name.
Yeah. Say the name. Yeah, that's wrong. It's very wrong. But to give someone Malkus, to give him Malkus, you probably have to do something more serious than that. And again, we're over here, another mystery. What did he do serious enough to get the Rabbanim to whip him? We don't know. Now, the bigger mystery is like this. He was in Yerushalayim for around a year. And the reason why he leaves Yerushalayim is the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim ask him to go back to Egypt and raise money for them. Because they knew he was friendly with Raphael Joseph. Okay. That is a big fat... You understand the problem? This is like a problem. I can't believe Gershon Shalom is not so bothered. I'm very bothered by the problem.
I'm not so bothered.
Why is that a problem?
Because I hear they see it. Maybe it's something about his personality to train him. See, Malkus, let's just say his personality, let's call it that. And then they said,
okay,
you're a crazy guy, yeah, well, ask him, you know?
I don't know. Look, if Shabtai Tzvi would have done one of his radical moves, like celebrate a Yom Tov in the wrong time, I don't think they would have, I don't think, you know, I don't believe they would have. If he would have said Mater Surim, I don't think they would have allowed it.
They're trying to get rid of him in the same
time. No. He raised money for the Jews of Jerusalem. He did it successfully. He sent back, let's say, on modern equivalents, you know, $152,000.
You can stay
I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay. And one guess is he did something funny similar to the fish story. Because that's like really strange. That's a strange thing to do. That if he gets a public, if the public is turned on by it, the mass public is turned on by it, then it could seem to be dangerous. But it's not halakhically radical enough. I mean, it's just crazy. The guy's just not normal. But he seems to be like stepping towards a different religion. So I think it's more logical to say he did something on these lines rather than something what is more radical, like celebrating Pesach.
Why did people like put him in a hospital or lock him up? Obviously, it's always crazy.
There was no the crazy people weren't locked up until modern times. Okay, let's see where we are here. Okay, so it goes back to Egypt. And as promised, now we're going to talk about Shabtai Tzvi's third wife. Shabtai Tzvi's third wife's name was Sarah. She is a very interesting character. Okay, again, like much else in Shabtai Tzvi's story, there's a lot of in clarity about fact and fiction. And Shabtai Tzvi's infamous third wife is another example of it. Okay, she was definitely of Polish/Ashkenazi origin. Her exact story is not clear. There are variant conflicting sources to exactly what happened. The basic two versions are she was orphaned as a child. Gershon Shalom assumes that means Tach V'Tach by Chalmanitsky in 1648. Around the age of six, she was raised in a Christian environment. It's the two basic versions are either in a nunnery or in a nobleman's house. She certainly, it definitely seems that she thought when she was 16, her father came to her in a dream and told her that she's Jewish, or reminded her that she's Jewish, and she needs to leave where she is and go somewhere else. And she did. Now, there are other two. Okay, she made her way to Amsterdam. It was also definitely in northern Italy because there's different people. In other words, the different a number of anti and pro Shabtai Tzvi people in both places knew who she was, remembered her from before her marriage to Shabtai Tzvi. In other words, there's Rabbi Yaakov Sespartus, who's from Amsterdam. He knew who she was beforehand. There are other people from northern Italy, some pro and some anti-Shabtai Tzvi, who also know who she was. There are a number of independent observers who also report her being in these places. Okay. She was known for being having loose morals.
His third wife.
What?
His third wife.
Yes. And she's also accused of witchcraft.
Oh, she seemed to be a good man.
Okay, yes and no. In other words, there is a major mystery. Shabtai Tzvi, when he wasn't manic and sang Matir Asurim, was really a very religious Jew.
Right.
And usually, very religious Jews are not interested in marrying people like this.
Usually.
Yeah.
Usually.
Okay.
Okay, so there is one source, but it's not that clear. There's one source that he thought he was going in the footsteps of the prophet Hosea. Hosea.
Where is this only the morning, or where do we no, but no, not so where do we learn all this from?
What about Shabtai Tzvi? I'll explain that to you later. You could have it doesn't say it over here. It says Hosea was commanded to marry a prostitute.
Oh.
Okay, so really the Radak says he didn't. The Radak says only Bamar Navua, he didn't really do it. But others are definitely seem he did. And there are some sources which say that Shabtai Tzvi thought he's like echoing Hosea. And, you know, making tikkunim, fixing things up by marrying this woman of loose morals. There's a lot of other information. Just, you guys didn't really hear this, but Shabtai Tzvi, when he married his first two wives, was unable to consummate the marriage.
Ever?
The first two wives, yes. He gave them gittin, he divorced them, because he felt he was too holy to consummate the marriage. Let's just finish off Sarah. We're not finishing her off. We're finishing off her, the basic story of Sarah, Mrs. Tzvi. Her dream was not only... She had a dream that she would marry Mashiach.
She had a dream?
She had a dream. I have a dream. She had a dream that she would marry Mashiach. Now, she definitely thought she did that when she married Shabtai Tzvi. Because he had already been claiming his Mashiach since 1648. And we're holding now in 1663 or 1664. Unclear exactly where, but we're closing in on Shabtai Tzvi's open declarations. We're getting very close. There are two versions of this. One version is he heard about a girl who was in northern Italy, in Livorno, claiming she's the woman who should marry Mashiach. And he sent for her, and she came, and he said, "You're my soulmate," and he got married. That's one version. And they met when he was in Raphael Joseph's house, and the wedding happened in Raphael Joseph's house.
It's
like Peter. Isn't it? Okay. The other version is she managed to make her way to Alexandria, and Shabtai Tzvi heard of the rumors that she claimed she should marry Mashiach. And he, in other words, and then he married her. And the whole difference is, did he hear of it? It's like a slight difference. You know, it's more dramatic. I've read dramatized versions of the Shabtai Tzvi story. And they like the first version, that he heard of it and he sent for her, because that's very dramatic. But it's not really historically clear that's what happened. It is historically clear and accepted that she thought that she had this dream she'd marry Mashiach. And she went, and then Ki'il, she went and married Shabtai Tzvi.
Pretty lofty goal for someone of her nature.
Well, yes and no. It's you're like being postmodernly, and you're slightly oversimplifying it, being postmodern. Today's world, the standard world doesn't believe in spirituality as reality, and it's a good question exactly when that changed. And changes like this, cultural changes of cultural norm, take not 5 years, a lot of them take 50, 100, 200 years to completely change. And I'm happy to discuss it over dinner with you. You can come back Shabbos and I'll discuss it then. If I'm lucky enough to get to the Tzfat trip again, then maybe I can discuss it then. But anyway, it was, it's, you're assuming that, you find it very strange that someone with such loose morals can have spiritual goals. Of course, it's absolutely a joke to like take a spiritual goal like that seriously. But in the world, in the pre-modern world or early modern world, spirituality was accepted reality. So it's not as difficult as you think. Fine.